I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and thanks for wrapping up your week with us here on The Takeaway. And it's been a big week. On Tuesday, the world welcomed our 8th billionth person.
Whoa.
And the next day, Republicans won their 218th seat in the Congress, which meant they flipped control of the House of Representatives, even while several races remain uncalled. And then on Thursday, Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced her plans to step down as House Speaker. She's led Democrats for 2 decades, and she is going to remain in Congress as a representative from California.
For me, the hours come for a new generation to lead the Democratic caucus that I so deeply respect. And I'm grateful that so many are ready and willing to shoulder this awesome responsibility.
As for their part, House Republicans nominated current Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy to become the new Speaker, pending a vote on the House floor in January. Here's Representative McCarthy at a press conference earlier this week.
I'm proud to announce the era of one-party Democrat rule in Washington is over. Washington now has a check and balance. The American people have a say in their government. And this new Republican leadership team is ready to get to work to put America back on the right track.
And President Joe Biden now has a clearer picture of the legislative landscape for the remaining 2 years of his first term. So, if you felt the earth moving under your feet a bit this week, don't fret. That's just the power shifting and unsettling in Washington, D.C. But before the 118th Congress takes its seats just after the new year, there's still a narrow window for some legislative action by the 117th. The remainder of 2022, this period between election and the installment of the successors, known as, come on, y'all know this one, a lame duck session. This could be the last chance for Democrats to use their majority in both chambers of Congress to pass some big legislation. In fact, they've already started that work. On Wednesday, the Senate voted to advance a bipartisan same-sex marriage bill, which would protect marriage equality under federal law. And Congress just set up its first federal cannabis bill designed to expand medical marijuana research. And lawmakers, well, they still need to pass a budget to avoid a looming government shutdown by December 16th. Whew, I thought I had a lot to do with hosting Thanksgiving dinner and getting ready for the holidays. With me now is co-president of Community Change, co-chair of the Economic Security Project, and my co-host for Takeaway Deep Dives, Dorian Warren. Dorian, glad to have you with us.
Great to be back with you, Melissa.
All right. I'm going to start by asking you to put your scholarly political science hat on for a second here and help us understand, why is it that lame duck sessions offer kind of an opportunity to take some legislative action that might not otherwise exist?
Well, as you already said, a lame duck session is that period, that interim period between a sitting Congress or a set of legislatures and the newly elected legislators who will be sworn in early January. And so especially in times of unified government, and as you know, we've been living through the last couple of years, a unified presidency in terms of the Democratic President Joe Biden with a Democratic House and Senate. We now know, because the House will turn to Republican rule, that this is the last opportunity for Democrats to try to pass their agenda without a lot of strife and turmoil, although there will be much in the lame duck session.
So it was so funny for me to hear Kevin McCarthy saying, oh, you know, now we'll go away from this one party, you know, Democratic majority. And I guess it's surprising to me, maybe that's his sort of positionality in the House. But honestly, given that the Senate is operating on this like supermajority reality, it hasn't particularly felt like Democrats can just do whatever they want.
That's exactly right, because the threshold, if you think about the role in the Senate of the filibuster or the threat of the filibuster, for most legislation in Congress to pass, you need 60 votes, not just a majority of 50 votes, with the exception of budgetary-related items through a process called reconciliation, where Democrats or, frankly, Republicans, if they controlled the chamber, only need 50 plus one votes. And so most of the things that will be on the agenda in the lame duck, actually, Melissa, will require 60 votes except for budgetary matters. So think about budget appropriations, either a full appropriations bill or what's called a continuing resolution, which is a temporary spending effort. And then there is something that's going to be on the lame duck agenda, I think, this session, this next month or so. And that's the debt ceiling. That's the ability of the federal government to borrow money to pay its bills and not default on its debts. And so we know already, and we've been hearing, that Democrats want to try to use the reconciliation process, where they only need 50 plus one votes, to raise the debt ceiling before it expires next year in 23, because they worry that Republicans will use it as a weapon to prevent Democratic priorities, and particularly to usher in cuts in social programs like Social Security or Medicare. And so, again, be thinking about this in two tracks: budgetary matters that only need a majority, but most everything else needs 60 votes. And in fact, we already know this week that in terms of marriage equality, the Respect for Marriage Act, that got more than 60 votes in the Senate to pass.
That is super helpful. And I will say, Congress is not going to be alone in seeking to get a little more credit, you know, in December around the holidays. A lot of folks are going to be looking to raise their debt ceiling in their individual households. So I get that. I also am interested in the ways that, since you make this point about the budget isn't just what we would think of as a budget in our household, right? This much on groceries, this much on the rent, this much on childcare. But it is actually has all these other pieces in it. And so let's go to that childcare piece. I understand there's a possibility that in this budget, which is operating on the track you pointed out as the simple majority track, that we might be looking at a lame duck possibility of expansion of that child tax credit. What's going on with that?
This goes back to, frankly, the previous president's tax cuts, primarily benefiting the wealthy, that are some aspects of it are set to expire. And so in this case, there are something called tax extenders. These are essentially tax breaks for corporations around research and development. They have expired. Most big businesses want these extended, because who doesn't like free money? And so the idea is that, if you remember from last year, the American Rescue Plan, there was a temporary expansion of the child tax credit. And why it's important, and I'm glad you raised this, the child tax credit over just 6 months last year reduced child poverty by 46%. It ushered in the lowest levels of child poverty for Black, Latino, and Indigenous kids on record in this country in just 6 months, but it was temporary. And it expired. And so one of the issues being talked about is, can you use the tax extenders debate in legislation in terms of what big business wants to essentially make a trade and say, if corporations want tax breaks, how about giving tax cuts to working families and to parents of children in exchange? So the idea is to try to extend the child tax credit as kind of a trade for extending corporate tax breaks. And so you're seeing a lot of positioning already by Democrats saying, essentially agenda setting, saying they're going to raise this and they're going to try to win some kind of a permanent expansion of the child tax credit in exchange for an extension of corporate tax breaks.
All right. So this is fascinating to me. I mean, maybe just because we're political scientists, but it really does go to this question of, like, shifting incentives for the lawmakers. I mean, how is it that a child tax credit, which had that kind of impact, right, lifting so many children out of poverty so swiftly, how was it ever even allowed to expire before a midterm election? You would think that would be the kind of thing that, especially for all of those families that were saying the economy was at the top of their agenda, that they would have also been saying, and hey, where's that money that was coming into my bank account automatically that went away, right, kind of right as folks needed it?
It's bewildering in a sense, Melissa, because the child tax credit, and I would add in here a companion policy, the earned income tax credit, two of this country's best poverty fighting policies, to be honest, in terms of the empirical data, They used to be bipartisan issues. And in this growing period of really stark political polarization, where you basically have both parties, in fact, being unified in terms of their policy agendas and just opposing issues. And particularly, we know it's asymmetric polarization. And so the Republican Party has essentially opposed anything that the Democratic Party has put on the table, even if they supported it previously. This is, in political science terms, this asymmetric polarization has been a defining feature of our governance over the last two decades. And so that is one explanation for why the child tax credit was allowed to expire. You, as you said, you would imagine that politicians across the aisle would be running on this issue, and that's just not the case. And so this is the next best attempt by Democrats and frankly the White House to try to get across the finish line one of their priority issues over the last 2 years.
If we're thinking about the other pieces of a broad agenda that might start moving through this lame duck, I was really interested to see yesterday the Washington Post published from civil rights organization The Color of Change a report card about tech, right? And the ways that lawmakers have failed or succeeded around tech. And given the news that will not stop out of Elon Musk's Twitter, I'm wondering if there's also an opportunity in the lame duck session to maybe move on some of these questions around equity, around justice, on tech concerns that, again, organizations like Color of Change and others have been putting on the table.
I think there's more of an opportunity now with Twitter in particular under Elon Musk's control than there was before he took control, to be honest, because there's the chaos that has been seeded over the last couple of weeks. It has really elevated this issue. So in some ways, you could think of it this way. Elon Musk, as you know, one of the richest people in the world, or what you might call, this is a political science term, an oligarch, has set the agenda around tech issues because he's created a crisis that needs to be solved. There was already a slow-burning crisis for many years in terms of misinformation, disinformation, the spewing of hate on various tech platforms. But now this issue is more and more on the front of the agenda. So I think this is an interesting and rare opportunity for movement on tech equity issues in a way that wasn't there just, say, a month ago. You know, there's a range of other equity issues, Melissa. You've already mentioned marriage equality. There's also, I want to bring up, in terms of an issue of democracy, the Electoral Count Act, which is also going to be in the lame duck agenda as a way to prevent the next January 6th insurrection. And it just codifies and clarifies the process of how we count our electoral votes, including saying that the vice president's position is purely symbolic and ceremonial, which we thought it was before last January 6th, 2021.
All right. Hold on, because there's one more that I want us to talk about. So, Dorian, don't go away, because another core issue sitting here on the lame duck Congress wish list is immigration. And I want to talk about immigration and immigration reform when we come back. Don't go away. We're going to keep talking about what's on the agenda for the lame duck session. It's The Takeaway.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and still with me is Dorian Warren. Thanks for sticking around, Dorian.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Now, Dorian and I are continuing our conversation about the remaining weeks of the 117th Congress. That's the window we call the lame duck session. And it does potentially offer opportunities for some swift progress on some big issues. So let's turn to one of the most critical on the agenda, potential immigration reform. Is this the moment when meaningful and perhaps even comprehensive reform can happen? Joining Dorian and me now is Bruna Solid. She is Senior Communications and Political Director of United We Dream, the largest nonprofit immigrant youth-led community in the country, who have for a long time been fighting for immigration reform. Bruna, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right, so let me just start with DACA. It was established by executive order. It has been fiercely litigated in the courts basically ever since, putting Dreamers in legal limbo. is there a possibility of legislative instantiation in the lame duck?
Well, so I'm a DACA recipient myself. I was born in Brazil and I grew up in Florida. I've had DACA since 2012. I remember applying for DACA the day they opened up applications. My sister and I both have it. So I think for me, and for many people who have DACA, we've been on this roller coaster for a very long time of like, what is going to happen? When are we finally going to have something permanent? So every window of opportunity, we want to push that through, right? We want to make sure that we take advantage of every opportunity. We have 6 weeks for Congress to get something done. So I'm hopeful. I think we have momentum on our side after coming out of the election just last week. I mean, great results in Nevada, Arizona, right? Being able to secure such important seats. And so I'm excited for the next 6 weeks because I think it's important to talk about what could potentially happen if DACA goes away next year, which is a very real threat. And so I really think Congress needs to realize like it's now or you're going to have chaos in your hands once DACA ends.
Bruna, can you say a bit more about the threats? I mean, we know that starting in 2017, the former president tried to eliminate DACA. And I know there's a looming threat next year in terms of the Supreme Court. Can you talk to us about what that threat is?
Yeah. And I think a lot of people probably remember that in 2020, we had a case at the Supreme Court, right, while Trump was president, because Trump and his administration were trying to kill the program. And we won. We were victorious at the Supreme Court, and a lot of people didn't think we were going to win, but we did. We were able to, I'll say, change the hearts and minds of the Supreme Court justices and get a 5-4 decision because we made it very clear that the Trump administration would deport immigrant young people if he was able to get rid of DACA. That was what we were fighting to make clear was the threat. However, Republicans have not let up. Even though immigrant young people won that case on the Supreme Court in 2020, the case we're, fighting against now is a case about is DACA legal or not? And unfortunately, because of the way that the Republicans have been able to control the courts and put in their judges, we've gotten a judge, Judge Hanen, which a lot of people know him. Historically, he's been very anti-immigrant. He's out of Texas. And he, last year, ruled against DACA. And his rule meant that DACA renewals could continue for current DACA recipients like myself, like my sister, but anyone aging into DACA for the first time, so when you turn 15 and 16, you're able to apply for the first time, those young people cannot apply for it anymore. So there's 80,000 applications sitting at USCIS that haven't been able to be accepted. There's estimated over 400,000 young people that are aging into the program over the last few years who are living without not only deportation protections, but a work permit, which both of you know is so important when you need to provide for your family, when you need to have healthcare, right? Like those basic necessities of human life. And so that's where we are right now. We received that decision from Judge Hanen last year, and it's going through, the Fifth Circuit and all of that, and potentially go back to the Supreme Court as early as next year. And we know that the makeup of the Supreme Court is even harder than it was in 2020, and nothing pro-immigrant is going to come out of that makeup of the Supreme Court. And I think if the Roe v. Wade decision showed us anything is that nothing is sacred or protected at the Supreme Court, and we can't wait for chaos, right? Y'all know this. There's so many women out there suffering right now because of this decision at the Supreme Court, and we can't wait for that to happen with DACA. We have to do it now. Let's pass citizenship now. So, however this plays out in the court, you don't have 600,000 DACA recipients losing their DACA, but millions of American families, right? Like I have a 9-month-old son. He's a U.S. citizen. There's 300,000 U.S. citizen children with a parent that has DACA. My son doesn't understand, what's going on, but his health care is tied to my DACA, to my work permit. And so I think what's really clear to me that this is not just about DACA, this program. This is about millions of American families that would just face chaos if DACA was to go away.
Bruna, as you make that point about the chaos that would be faced if DACA goes away, because, as you're pointing out, you're the mom of a U.S. citizen child. Many DACA recipients have parents, elders, often siblings, right, who are not DACA recipients or are ineligible for it. In these mixed status families, as we're looking at the need for immigration reform, what else would be on that list to keep this kind of chaos from affecting mixed status families?
Melissa, you're exactly right. This is not just about DACA, right? It's about millions of families that are impacted by this. I think, you know, there was this week on Wednesday, there was a press conference in front of Congress with Senator Schumer, Senator Durbin, Senator Cortez Masto, Senator Padilla, where they made it very clear that they see this as a priority, that they see citizenship for immigrant young people as a priority during the lame duck. I think what I'll say is I want to be realistic about what we need to get this passed. We need 10 Republicans. And as you both know, to get 10 Republicans on a bill is very challenging, no matter what the issue is, because Republicans have just been, I'm from the state of Florida. I remember when Senator Rubio was someone who would be pro an immigration bill, a citizenship bill, right? That's no longer the case. The Republican Party has, you know, gone to the extreme right in terms of being anti-immigrant and lying about immigrants. And I think just completely forgetting like the states they represent, right? Someone like Marco Rubio, a state like Florida, has millions of undocumented immigrants who contribute to the state's economy, to, you know, communities in the state. And he's gone completely silent.
Dorian Warren is co-president of Community Change and co-chair of the Economic Security Project. And Bruna Solid is the senior communications and political director of United We Dream. Bruna, Dorian, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.